Just because nuclear power saw its origins in the 1940s with the Manhattan Project doesn't mean that it's the same thing as nuclear weapons. All sorts of technologies that we enjoy today were developed in a military setting initially. Chemotherapy is a good example. The chemotherapies that we use today are direct descendants from mustard gas that was used to kill enemies in World War I. The rockets that we use to explore space and launch GPS satellites were developed to deliver bombs. The satellites that are in orbit around Mars right now, mapping the surface, were initially used to spy on enemy countries during the Cold War. Just because the technology saw its origin during a military setting doesn't mean that it can't be and shouldn't be used peacefully.
So I'm going to open today's debate with the chance for each speaker to give us a brief kind of 3-minute pitch in response to an opening question. And that is, do we need nuclear power to build a future of clean energy? Tim, let's start with you.
Okay, so hi, everybody. I'm a scientist and I love little experiments, so just humour me for just a minute. Pay attention to what emotions are invoked when I put the following words to you. Uranium, plutonium, gamma rays, radioactivity, nuclear waste, Chernobyl. Okay, if you're like most people, you probably had a gut negative reaction to these words. Perhaps you felt trepidation, fear, mistrust, perhaps even anger or sadness. And I don't blame anybody for feeling these things. It's perfectly understandable because we are all of us immersed in a culture that reinforces the message that nuclear is bad. It's dangerous, it's full of peril, it's stay away and keep out. And whilst there are legitimate criticisms of nuclear power, and some of those I hold myself, the evidence suggests that most criticism is based on emotion rather than evidence. I lay my cards on the table and say that the evidence, as far as I can see it, suggests that we should embrace nuclear power if we're to decarbonise our world and mitigate the worst effects of climate change, not as a last resort either, but as the next exciting step in human progress. But in a way, it doesn't really matter what I think of nuclear power. It matters more what you think of nuclear power. And so as you listen to the conversation unfold and you go away and you ponder these things and you perhaps even make up your mind, keep the following pieces of evidence in mind. There's a perception that nuclear power is dirty and bad for the environment, but the evidence shows that it's actually the cleanest way to generate power. It's got a carbon footprint comparable to wind, and of all power sources, it uses the least amount of land, it requires the least amount of minerals, and it requires the least amount of mining. There's a perception that it's dangerous, and yet the evidence shows that it's as safe as wind and solar, and more people die every 30 minutes from fossil fuel-related air pollution than died in Chernobyl. There's a perception that nuclear waste is unsolvable, yet Finland, which has got a grid that's 40% nuclear, has designed and implemented a working geological storage solution. There's a perception that it's hideously expensive, yet the evidence shows that when you account for system costs, grid balancing, transmission, backup and storage, intermittence and reliability, nuclear is competitive with wind and solar. And there's a perception that it takes too long as well, and we don't have time to roll out a big fleet of nuclear reactors before our mid-century net zero deadlines. But the evidence shows that the median build time for a reactor globally today is just 6 years. Not that long, considering that they last upwards of 60 years plus once they're built. And France in the 1970s shows that it is possible to deploy this technology at scale and at pace. France increased its nuclear generation more in 10 years than Germany has increased its renewable generation in the last 25. And so most of the criticism of nuclear power is based on emotion rather than evidence. The evidence to the contrary says that we should embrace it.
Thank you, Tim. Perfectly timed.
Thank you.
Sheila, over to you.
So, Tim, I have to begin by saying that I'm in a field in which that distinction between emotion and evidence is not actually accepted as a valid distinction, because we take things to be evidence only when we're emotionally committed to finding evidence in support of our views or against our views to some extent. I've been following the debate on nuclear power as part of a much broader portfolio of work I do on environmental risks and environmental management writ large. And it is an extraordinary case study in just how complicated technological systems are and why we constantly get wrong where the dangers are going to be coming from. So every nuclear accident and near accident has been about a different thing that broke down in the system. And there's always the post-hoc explanation about why it couldn't happen here. But I think the bigger generalization is that when you have a complicated technological system, things could go wrong at many, many different points. But more than that, I think that the focus on talking about whether nuclear power is safe or not, is dangerous or not, is the solution or not, really is the wrong focus. It's about our capacity to govern complicated technological systems that have obvious downsides to them. And, you know, just as Tim says that the answer to whether we go nuclear or not lies in all of you and all of us. I think, by the way, that it doesn't. I think that an Apple or a Google can decide whether we go nuclear to a much higher degree than a Sheila Jasanoff can. So in that sense, I don't think the power is equally distributed in all of our hands. But I think that the one of the sort of wake-up moments for me was when Richard Garwin, a very eminent scientist who just recently died and a very ardent advocate of nuclear power, came to talk at Harvard a number of years ago. And he would have been music to your ears because he was saying that because of all the technological advances since Chernobyl, for instance, we were now able to deploy nuclear power safely and at scale. This is already about 10 years ago or more. The only problems that stand in our way, he said, are public acceptance and what to do about nuclear waste. Now, stop for a moment and think, and we can come back to this, but public acceptance and what we do about nuclear waste are two problems that have dogged the development of nuclear power from day one. So if 50 years, 60 years into the development, an ardent advocate, an eminent physicist is saying, oh, well, there's awkward things, you know, public acceptance, radioactive waste, it means that we haven't actually solved the problem of governance. And I think that that's what I would like to spend some of our conversational time talking about. Why is it that we don't seem to be able to solve the question of governance in a democratic and reliable way around this dangerous technology of nuclear power?
Thank you. A lot there to pick up on already. Yes, thank you. But before we dive in, Ramana, do you want to take it away?
Thank you. I like the question that Tim started us off about what are your emotional reactions. And I was actually probing my mind. And I couldn't come up with any emotional reaction when I heard of all these things. And that's because, as my daughter once said, I'm an emotional robot. I don't think emotionally. I don't, whatever, various things. But it's also interesting that, you know, in many circumstances when I'm asked to talk, and of course, many of people already know what I'm going to say, for better or worse, the Verso books that published my book, their marketing department said it has to have a bold, clear title, like nuclear is not the solution. So there's no ambiguity here about what I think about, right? So they always say, oh, you're an anti-nuclear. And I say, I'm not actually anti-nuclear. I'm anti-nuclear weapons. I have a moral and ethical position against weapons of mass destruction, including nuclear weapons. But in the case of nuclear energy, I think that the costs and the risks vastly outweigh the benefits. And what I mean by that is that there are the two sort of costs that Tim mentioned. And of course, we disagree on many of the numbers. I mean, the numbers itself, we will probably agree, but how we interpret those numbers, we probably will disagree. Nuclear energy remains the most expensive source of energy. All of the new nuclear reactors that we have built have costed enormous amounts. So, for example, the one that was built in the United States in Vogel, the two AP1000 reactors, cost about $37 billion. That's the most expensive power plant ever built in the United States. Likewise, the Hinkley Point C that's being built here is going to be the most expensive power plant ever built in the UK, right? And this is after decades and decades of experience with building nuclear plants. And if you look at the evidence, you see that the reactors that were built afterwards in the subsequent decades have costed more than in the past. And so nuclear power is kind of an exception to the general rule that technologies often become cheaper as you build more and more, because alongside all of the experience that you learn in the manufacturing and the ways of trying to make it more efficient, you also learn about new ways that a nuclear reactor can have a catastrophic accident. So before Fukushima, for example, we did not know, we have never seen the case of a nuclear plant having a meltdown because there is a, what we call a station blackout. There's no external source of electricity. And then at some point, all of the internal source of electricity, including the diesel generators, stop working, right? And so once Fukushima has happened, if you're going to deploy new nuclear plants, you want to make sure that you have additional safety systems that try to deal with these kind of contingencies. And so newer nuclear plants end up costing more. And that's going to be the trend. And as Sheila mentioned, we have a lot of evidence from people who study accidents that show that we can never predict all possible failure modes. This is sort of work that originally was done by a sociologist called Charles Perrow in a book called Normal Accidents, which is a path-breaking book. And sort of that insight still holds when it comes to nuclear power. The other main object that I think we should be thinking about is how long it takes. And it's interesting. So Tim mentioned the median age is 6 years. I would talk about the mean time, and the mean time is about 10 years to go between the point where you pour concrete into the ground to the point where the nuclear reactor starts generating electricity and supplies it to the grid. But that 10 years is not really a good capture. So in British Columbia, where I live, there are no nuclear plants. If tomorrow some government were to decide BC should build a nuclear power plant, they can't just go ahead and start building. They would have to, first of all, find a site where there's a community that is willing to live near this hazardous facility, where they know that someday there could be an accident. They would have to leave their houses and probably never come back because it's radioactively contaminated. They would have to go through all of the safety checks. They'd have to go through an environmental assessment process. And most importantly, raise the tens of billions of dollars that you need to build one of these plants. That process takes a long time and typically the order of 5 to 10 years. So if you look at all of the plants that have come online recently, they've all flowed about 20 years after the decision has been made. And we don't have that kind of time to deal with climate change.
So I'm sure there's a lot of points that you'll want to pick up on there. Thank you, Ranna. But I want to start actually just sort of by reflecting on the fact that even among sort of experts in the field and scientific experts in particular, where we think of this as something that might be sort of purely factual, there remains this kind of very enduring division in perspective. And so I want to start with you, Sheila, actually, just to reflect on what do you think makes nuclear energy so divisive even to this day?
Yeah, so Adrian, I was thinking about how you began the story with Chernobyl. And I would begin this story with Hiroshima and not Chernobyl. And even Hiroshima has a history. So the whole idea that we would take this enormous locked up force inside the atom and let it loose first came about in wartime, at least the first demonstration project. And we actually needed in America a positive program, which was titled Atoms for Peace, as a way of counteracting the set of negative views that people had legitimately formed about letting the genie out of the bottle, in a sense. And so from the beginning, I think nuclear power has been seen as, you know, kind of the presentable twin of the unthinkable power that had already been let loose in war. And I think that's a very difficult boundary to maintain. It's very difficult to take something that people think is poisonous for humanity and then say, no, no, suddenly we're going to turn it to peaceful purposes. But so that's part of the story. And a historian named Spencer Wirt wrote a book a long time ago called Nuclear Fear, in which he traced back the fear of radiation way further back than even the bomb. And, you know, Marie Curie died of exposure to radionuclides. Of course, we can say technology has advanced and we know how to guard against many of these things. We don't deliver medical x-rays at the same doses now that we did 25 or 30 years ago, because we understand that we don't need as much of the same thing. But again, if you follow the history of nuclear risks and nuclear breakdowns, you find that they come from previously, you know, sort of unchecked kinds of sources. And if you are a student of risk assessment, as I am, you find that over and over and over again, the risk assessors have discovered that their original imagination for what could go wrong was incredibly constrained, that they weren't thinking about a lot of different things that could go wrong. This began right with atomic secrets, that enormous precautions were taken to keep the secrecy of the Los Alamos project hidden. But people forgot that there might actually be the spy within who would reveal the secrets, and nobody would have thought about him. So that's a very, you know, evocative lesson in how limited our mindsets get, especially when we carry out highly technical, black-boxed, and closed-in operations, which are classic around nuclear power.
Tim, did you want to respond to that?
Yeah, sure. So just a quick note on Marie Curie. She was actually older than the life expectancy in France when she died, which is quite an interesting thing to know. She didn't actually die that young. Just because nuclear power saw its origins in the 1940s with the Manhattan Project doesn't mean that it's the same thing as nuclear weapons. All sorts of technologies that we enjoy today were developed in a military setting initially. Chemotherapy is a good example. The chemotherapies that we use today are direct descendants from mustard gas that was used to kill enemies in World War I. The rockets that we use to explore space and launch GPS satellites and mobile internet into space were developed to deliver bombs to other countries. The satellites that are in orbit around Mars right now, mapping the surface, were initially used to spy on enemy countries during the Cold War. Just because a technology saw its origin during a military setting doesn't mean that it can't be and shouldn't be used peacefully today. As for the appetite for risk, nothing is without risk. In society, we all accept a little bit of risk for some benefit. And rather than trying to eliminate risk completely, which I don't think anybody would seriously suggest, I think that we need to get real and try and maximise the amount of societal benefit for the minimum amount of risk and accept the trade-off. I mean, we could eliminate road deaths, of which there are tens of millions every year globally, by setting the global speed limit to 5 miles per hour. Nobody would die on the road anymore. It's actually pretty dangerous driving cars. But that would be unacceptable to people. We accept the traffic accidents and the deaths on the road so that we can all get about our days and move around faster than 5 miles per hour. And so it goes with our energy systems. It's not that nuclear is perfectly safe. Actually, when you look at the data, if you look at the number of fatalities from nuclear power over the last 70 years, we've been doing this for a long time now. It's about 70 years we've been doing nuclear power. If you add up all those fatalities and include them from Chernobyl and Fukushima and other nuclear accidents, and you set those fatalities in context with the number of megawatt hours of energy that we've generated from nuclear power, you find that it's actually on a par with wind and solar. And so as for the safety aspect, safety isn't a reason not to do nuclear power. The safety record of nuclear power is a reason to do more of it. They're not just a little bit safer than fossil fuels. They are orders of magnitude safer than fossil fuels. Whether you care about climate change or not, the air pollution and the deaths from air pollution every year are avoidable and are tragic in an age when we could credibly replace them with emissions-free sources.
Mm. And Ramana, do you think that nuclear can be sort of divorced from its military background and or that the risks are overstated?
So first I'd say one thing to what Tim last said, which is he was contrasting nuclear power with fossil fuels. Now, none of us are advocating for fossil fuels. The fossil fuel industry is doing that, but none of us here, I assume, are advocating for that. So when I'm asked that question, it's like asking me whether I want to die of cancer or heart attack. I don't want either of them, right? So... So I think that's trying to look at something really risky and point to the fact that nuclear is less risky than that is not, I think, a valid argument that we should be entertaining. And the second thing, that also the analogy with driving and car accidents is also interesting, because yes, we all drive, or many of us drive, not all of us. We are all sitting in cars at some point or the other. But usually there's a presumption that if I am driving safe, I'm wearing my seatbelt, I'm being under the speed limit, I'm not drunk, then my chances of escaping being hit in an accident are pretty low. There's some control I have over this. People in the general public have zero control over what's going on inside a nuclear plant, right? It's run by a group of people. And the same is true in a lot of other high-tech areas. So if you think, go back to the financial crisis in 2007, 2008, the people who are running the financial markets, they were very confident that this would work. They had mathematical models that they thought were going to show that you'd never have a collapse, because they had this assumption that the housing market can only go one way, which is up, right? The moment the housing market collapsed, everything collapsed, right? So mathematical models always have to be taken with a grain of salt. You have to understand fully well what the assumptions there are, and then try to understand whether there are circumstances under which you could have catastrophic failure, right? And so this is not something which the ordinary person can immediately trust the so-called expert, because if an expert is somebody like in the financial industry who benefits from a particular technology being deployed, they have an incentive to saying that their technology is safe, right? Whether it's nuclear or chemical weapons or any of these things. And this is also true for even things like nuclear waste disposal, right? So what we have in Finland is a claim by a group of people who have designed that repository saying that it is going to be safe for 100,000 years or whatever it is. But if you look at actual experience with repositories, so there's only one operating repository right now in the world which deals with any kind of radioactive waste, and that's the waste isolation pilot plant in the United States in New Mexico. And WIP was designed to deal with what they call transuranic waste from the nuclear weapons program in the United States. And it was designed to contain these things for about 10,000 years. Well, roughly about 15 years after it opened, there was a big explosion involving a canister that had plutonium inside it. Somebody had switched the kind of chemical that was used to pack that thing, and that thing exploded, right? Nobody had foreseen this. So the safety, assurance that has been given, saying that it's going to operate for 10,000 years, didn't even hold for 15 years. So do we know that it is a repository in Finland is going to keep the waste safe for the next 10,000, 100,000 years? Of course we don't. We can trust these people if we want, but we do so at our peril in some sense.
Sheila, I want to bring you back in, but first I'm just going to allow Tim to respond to some of those points.
Comparing an above-surface interim storage facility with a geological
storage facility.
Sorry?
It is an underground facility.
They are not the same thing. Onkalo, which is the geological repository in Finland, is deep, deep, deep underground. And when it's full, it will be backfilled with it's the same type of clay that you get in cat litter. It expands underwater and self-seals. Thousands and thousands of engineers and scientists over the last 40 years have designed that facilities and the canisters. And it's kind of like driving. It's not just like there's a single point of protection around that geological repository. There are many, many, many layers of protection around that geological repository. And, you know, it's kind of interesting when we throw these timescales around, like 100,000 year, million year timescales, which is approximately what it takes for the radioactivity of nuclear waste to decay down into the general radioactivity that you would find beneath the ground of the Earth. They sound like awfully, awfully, awfully long times that are beyond us. But actually, geologically, 100,000 years or even a million years is barely anything. It's barely the blink of an eye. And so to deal with the problem of nuclear waste, which Finland have,
To continue watching this video, click the link in the top left or in the description below.
With a free trial, you can enjoy the full talk and thousands more.
Thank you for being part of the conversation.